Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. Now with the choice of Secretary of State front and center in the transition process and the Donald Trump effect already being felt in countries from Israel to the Philippines, as written up in today's New York Times, Times national security correspondent David Sanger joins us. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be with you.
And listeners, your questions for David Sanger on the Trump effect already taking shape around the world, or what makes a good Secretary of State, or other things in his orbit, welcome at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let me ask you first, does it matter whether Mitt Romney or more of a flamethrower like Rudy Giuliani is Secretary of State, if whoever it is carrying out the policies of the president, does the person actually matter to outcomes in the world and for the United States?
Brian, good morning, and thanks for having me. Can you repeat the question? We had a little bit of an audio glitch there.
Sure. I just asked if it matters who the person is in the office of Secretary of State very much, whether it's a more diplomatic type like Mitt Romney or more of a flamethrower like Giuliani. Since they do the bidding of the president, does the person actually matter to outcomes?
Matters tremendously, because the Secretary of State turns out to be the place where the rubber hits the road. It's where the negotiations go on. It is where the person who is most directly talking to foreign governments and their deputies and so forth are. And it's the main way that he's the main interlocutor, in addition to being the primary foreign policy advisor to the president, just as the head of the Joint Chiefs is the primary military advisor to the president. Now, one of the issues that's come up, I mean, there are issues of temperament, obviously, and, you know, Mitt Romney is a very different person from Rudy Giuliani, who is a very different person from General Kelly or General Petraeus. One of the concerns that you've heard broadly is that if you stack up the entire system with former generals, we now have one who is the National Security Advisor. We've had that before. Brent Scowcroft, probably one of the greatest National Security Advisors, was an Air Force general. Colin Powell, obviously, and so forth.
Right now we'll have General Flynn.
You have General Flynn. If you end up with General Mattis at the Defense Department, usually the Defense Department's run by a civilian, and he would have to get a waiver from Congress in order to be able to do that. And if you then had either General Kelly or General Petraeus at the State Department, you would have former generals in the three primary national security posts. Now, of that group, I would say that General Petraeus has the mind more of a diplomat, even though he was clearly a warrior. Just if you know him and you think about how he thinks about geoeconomics and so forth and so on, I would say that he is unusual among the military crowd. But still, that's a pretty heavy bias. Now, we've had it happen before. General Marshall, George Marshall, of the Marshall Plan, was obviously one of the greatest generals of World War II, and he served as Secretary of State under Truman.
On the Giuliani side, some people say if Secretary of State is the country's chief negotiator, maybe it makes sense to have a tough guy in there, not a smooth-talking conciliator like people see Romney or maybe even Petraeus. You know, like people want hard-ass lawyers if they're in a lawsuit or a business negotiation, because that's the job of Secretary of State. Is that the job of Secretary of State?
Well, it requires both, because a lot of what you're doing is working with allies. So while you might want to have a really tough negotiator when you're doing the Iran negotiations, which I covered for several years, or if you're doing negotiations with Vladimir Putin and Russia, it's a different set of skills when you're trying to cajole NATO allies or Japan or South Korea to do more for your causes. And, you know, the goal of diplomacy is to try to show somebody that doing something in your interest is also in their interest. And that can at times mean hard-nosed diplomacy, and we certainly heard a lot of that from President-elect Trump, including in the two foreign affairs interviews that Maggie Haberman and I did with him in March and July, where he was laying out very tough positions for the allies, threatening to pull out of NATO, threatening to pull our troops out of East Asia. I think what he's going to discover quickly is that he's going to need to be able to bring a lot of the allies around on his side.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times, my guest as we talk about the transition at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And it may be a transition in this country, but as the Times documents in an article called The Trump Effect today, it's already having on-the-ground effects in the real world, around the real world. And so let me ask you about a few of these. That article, of course, was written by your colleague Peter Baker.
Yep.
With Trump taking the position that we should go after ISIS in Syria, not go after Assad and ISIS, is that affecting the war there already or the humanitarian situation?
Well, it certainly is affecting the calculus of Assad and the Russians, because until now they've been dealing with an administration which was trying to get them to bring about a ceasefire and was ultimately took the position that Assad cannot remain, or that it's impossible, I think was the last wording that they said, to imagine a transition in Syria in which Assad, having been responsible directly or indirectly for the deaths of nearly 500,000 of his own people, could remain as the leader. In the case of Donald Trump, you've got somebody who has said outright that he would sign up with the Russians and with Assad. He doesn't mention their other ally, Iran, in order to fight ISIS. Now, the problem he's going to run into is we can't find many cases in which the Russians have actually attacked ISIS. In fact, we can only really find one significant one. So the question is, would Mr. Trump discover quickly that he has signed up with a group that fundamentally isn't as interested in defeating ISIS as he is?
He must know that already, because it's been so widely reported that Putin is not attacking ISIS in Syria. The Russian forces are attacking the other rebels, the ones that the United States supports. So I wonder if you see the potential for early conflict between Putin and Trump over our competing interests in Syria, and there goes the bromance in the first few months, or if they actually may find a way to unite.
They might. I think the big question is, do they get off to a good start, as the Russians did with Obama, and then at some moment Putin does something that so crosses the line that the president feels double-crossed. That's certainly what happened when Putin went annexed Crimea and took part of Ukraine. If there was speculation about that in a Trump administration, it would be whether he would try to seize more of Ukraine, that piece that sort of runs from Crimea up to the Russian border that is largely Russian-speaking, or try to foment some uprising in the Russian-speaking parts of Latvia, a NATO ally, or Lithuania or Estonia, which are the other former Soviet states that joined NATO a number of years ago.
But my guess is that through Trump's America First lens, and a lot of Americans might actually agree with this, the U.S. doesn't have much interest in what happens in Latvia or Estonia or Ukraine. What we have an interest in is ISIS, which wants to attack us. And so maybe there's common ground to actually be found with Putin once Trump makes the agreement that we're basically going to leave Assad alone, and that's who Russia wants in power in Syria because, you know, it increases their influence in that region, that maybe Putin would then agree to go after ISIS kind of as payback for Donald Trump as part of a deal, because Russia doesn't like the Islamists either. You know, they threaten Russia through through various means. And so then it's sort of hands off, you know, the immediate Russia area, the Baltics and Ukraine, where maybe there's not much U.S. interest anyway. Tell me if you think that's wrong. And then maybe Putin plays ball against ISIS.
Could well, and it's a question of what do you think is our most urgent and what is our most long-term set of interests. So everybody's in agreement, fighting ISIS is a highly important issue. Maintaining NATO together and keeping the Russians from fracturing the Western alliance is also an incredibly large American goal. And when you think about that one, what happens if you suddenly said, you know, most Americans couldn't find Latvia or Estonia or Lithuania on a map. We don't really care, so let the Russians mess around there, and we won't invoke Article 5, which is that part of the NATO treaty that says an attack on one is an attack on all. Now, if you did that, you've probably dismantled the main alliance structure that we put in place post-World War II. So there are bigger consequences out here, because at the moment that you don't come to the defense of a smaller NATO ally, the larger NATO allies are going to think, gee, they're going to come to my defense as well, you know. Same thing in Asia, and that's what led to that fascinating conversation that Mr. Trump and I had during the March interview, where he was talking about pulling troops out of South Korea and Japan if they didn't pay more for their support. And I said, well, that would lead them to distrust our nuclear umbrella, so they would likely go off and build their own nuclear weapons. Are you okay with that? And he said, well, it's going to happen anyway. So there are consequences two and three chess moves down the road to making decisions like that. And the question is how much they're thinking about those.
Let's take a phone call. Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alan.
Good morning. Although I'm not any great lover of the legacy of terrorism by Yasser Arafat, from a purely a standpoint of consistency, Kellyanne Conway seemed intolerant of the idea of having Romney be the Secretary of State because of intemperate remarks he made about Trump earlier in the season. But by that standard, how could she accept as Secretary of State Giuliani, who not only made intemperate remarks about Arafat while he was mayor, but I believe tried to eject him from the Lincoln Center at one point during his term, and that would not be viewed as a very favorable example of his diplomatic skills to the rest of the world.
Well, to the kind of diplomacy that they want to pursue around the world, being mean to Yasser Arafat is not the same as being mean to Donald Trump, who would be the president and your boss. But I don't know. Israel was an example, the prime example in Peter Baker's article today. So let's talk about that. The article said apparently Jewish settlements in disputed territory will resume construction now because of the government there's response to the fact that Donald Trump, rather than Hillary Clinton, is going to be the next president. Are you familiar with an instant effect in Israel?
Well, from Peter's reporting there, and one of the things that has happened in Jerusalem is they've held back on doing construction in places where they knew the United States posed objections and where the construction would become an irritant in the relationship between the Israeli government and the United States. And you remember this came up as early as one of Biden's first visits to Israel, where he discovered that they were going ahead with a construction program, or they were announcing a construction program that had been previously announced, but they sort of re-announced it and said they were getting going on it while Biden was in the country. And it caused a big kerfuffle at that moment. So the essence of this is that with Trump coming in, presumably offering no objections, there are players on the ground who are already calculating that they can get away with things that they might not have been able to get away with as easily when Barack Obama was president. And you're seeing people engage in such hedging activity around the world, I'm sure, Assad. And the Russians are doing it. I'm sure that when you go and you talk to people in Eastern Europe, they are all concerned about it. I saw a French delegation yesterday in Washington that was just trying to figure out how to play the Trump team, and they were meeting them for the first time. So we'll know a whole lot more 6 months from now when you'll be able to sort out which of the campaign promises and statements were rhetoric to get elected, and which ones were actually for real.
Of course, Trump has said that he and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will take a run at making peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. Is there a Trump approach to peace talks that could encompass new settlement activity, but they think could still lead to yes by both the Israelis and the Palestinians?
Brian, I've never heard him go into any detail about what that would be. Now, look, since the talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians have been frozen, in part because Netanyahu doesn't want to go do them, and in part because the Palestinians don't seem to have a group ready that is that can negotiate, and obviously they're divided very severely. It's sort of hard to understand who he's going to go get together. But it's not as if this is an area where the Obama administration made great progress. So if he's got a different way that can actually get this going, I think the world would welcome that.
And on Giuliani, he's seen as such a divisive blowhard by Democrats at this point. Can you tell, as somebody who reports from around the world, whether there are a lot of governments out there saying quietly or privately, please, no, not Rudy Giuliani?
You know, it's interesting. I haven't heard many of those, but in part I think that's because Rudy Giuliani is a larger figure, obviously, in New York politics and to some degree in American politics. He thought about running for president himself a few years back. Then he is a known quantity on the international stage. His international activity has largely been in his consulting business since he left as mayor. So I'm not sure that he's got quite as strong, that people have as much of a reaction to him. On the other hand, General Petraeus, who was in to see President-elect Trump yesterday, is very well known by world leaders from his time at the CIA, from his time at Central Command, from his time as the commander out in the Middle East. So he's got sort of a deeper network at high levels of foreign governments, and I think they know much more what they're getting with him.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times, and Michael in Missouri. You're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I served two tours in Iraq, and I was greatly impressed by the Kurds, and who are obviously located in northern Iraq. I know President-elect Trump did mention about empowering the Kurds and using them as a spearhead to clear out the remaining forces of ISIS in northern Iraq, or I guess in Iraq in general, and maybe even in northern Syria. And I wanted to get your guest's opinion on maybe even creating a Kurdistan, as it were, to maybe possibly use them as winning the war against ISIS.
David?
Well, the Kurds have been among the most effective fighters, for sure. And there's been a lot of debate, even within the Obama administration, about how to more empower them. The only problem with that is that you risk losing another NATO ally in this fight, and that's Turkey, which fears that if you created an independent Kurdistan, they would take a piece of Turkey with them or seek to or start up trouble within that part of Turkey. So they have fought that tooth and nail. And I asked the president-elect, when he was still a candidate, about how he would deal with problems like this. And he said meetings, a lot of meetings. Well, it's not as if we haven't had meetings on this topic. I mean, there are just fundamental national interests that people are dealing with here.
Michael, thank you very much.
Very good question. Yeah.
To that point, or a related point, they've already appointed the flamethrower General Flynn as National Security Advisor, as you mentioned before. So alienating, I imagine, to Muslim allies for having said things like, Islam is a cancer, not just violent jihadism, but he said Islam is a cancer, and, you know, talked about it's rational, tweeted that it's rational to fear Muslims put that way. If Trump is hoping to get Arab and Muslim countries in the Middle East to participate more in the fight against ISIS, in addition to the Kurds, does this alienate them, or do they brush that off?
Well, could well alienate them. We don't know how well they're going to, you know, brush any of this off. And, you know, you can say a lot of things during a campaign, and you can say some things during a transition. When you actually go down into the sit room as president and as the president's staff and run those deputy meetings and all that, and someone in the back of the room says, you know, we realize this sounds like a great idea, but you guys have been out of power for a while, and in case of many in the Trump team, including the president himself, hadn't served in government before. Actually, I guess it's only the president himself who had not served in government before. But let's tell you what happened the last time we tried this, or let's tell you what the second and third order effects are going to be. And I think that the first year of a presidency is all about learning about the second and third order effects of your activity. I'll give you another example out of that. Everybody is saying, rightly or wrongly, that could be the first big crisis of the Trump presidency could be North Korea. Obviously, they've made great progress in both their nuclear and missile programs in the past year or two. There'll be a group that will argue in favor of starting up negotiations, which would basically mean acknowledging their nuclear program, which President Obama has been reluctant to do. There will be a group arguing for unilateral action. And then someone's going to step in and say, let me tell you about our classified studies about what happens to Seoul in the first 24 hours of a conflict with North Korea. And you get that. It's a little sobering. And you think about losing the capital of one of the largest economies in the world, and what kind of casualties would be put together with that. So it just, the world just looks a lot more complicated when you have to go sit there and you're stripped away from the easy one-liners of presidential debates. And this is not limited to Donald Trump. It happens to Democrats, Republicans. If we had a Martian elected president, it would happen to the Martian.
Todd in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Todd.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
My point is, I am hopeful that Trump will be able to establish a better relationship with Putin and the Russians. If you listen to the words of Stephen Cohen, who is an emeritus professor of Russian studies at Princeton, and I believe is currently at NYU, he shares the same hopes. I mean, I don't think our relationship could get much worse. I think it's expedient for us to do just that. I mean, we can't certainly go to war with Russia, right, over Syria. That would be insane. So I'm hoping that Trump will be able to establish better communication, better relationships, hopefully with Russia. But I guess we will see. But that would be my hope.
Todd, thank you very much. Dan in Nassau County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
I'd like to kind of piggyback on what the last caller said. I think it's really critical we try to get a better relationship with the Russians. And I don't understand why the kind of foreign policy establishment and the status quo the last 25 years is, you know, getting so bent out of shape. You know, if you look at the three wealthiest countries in Europe, which I believe are France, Germany, and England, their combined economies dwarf Russia's. So the idea that they really can take the reins of their own defense in Europe isn't really anything extraordinary. And considering the large deficits we have here at home and the our own problems we need to take care of, I don't understand why it's so, you know, it's such an absurd idea for us to, you know, give more of their security responsibility to themselves.
Which is part of Trump's America First platform. David?
Well, it's an excellent point, and there's sort of two parts to it that I think are worth looking at. So let's take the second one first, which is, can the Europeans take on more of their own defense? Not only can they, they should. And this is not a position that Donald Trump invented. It was President Obama who referred to many of the Europeans as free riders. It was Bob Gates, the first Secretary of Defense in the Obama administration and the last Secretary of Defense in George W. Bush's administration, who was obviously held over for 2 years, who in his final speech in Europe said to the NATO allies, look, you guys don't get it. There is a new generation in the United States that has no memory of the Cold War, and they're not going to support this level of spending for this alliance forever. And you better wake up to this. So what Donald Trump has done is just take this to the next stage, which is rather than just issue a warning, he said, and if you don't do it, here's a set of consequences that might include our pulling back from the alliance. And that's what's caused the great horror. If it turns out that this is just a negotiating position to get them to spend more and be better coordinated in their own defense, I think a lot of people in the United States will cheer that. And a lot of Democrats will cheer that. And a lot of realpolitik types will cheer that. So I don't think that's outrageous at all. Nor do I think it's outrageous to think that we could improve our relationship with Russia. It couldn't get worse. Well, I guess it could, but it's gone straight downhill. And that means understanding Putin's own insecurities, many of which are based on Russia's shrinking economic stature. And so I think that would be a significant argument, too. And if he can make that work, great. The difficulty that they're going to run into is that the Russians are acting aggressively in a range of different areas, from submarines off of Europe to air flights right up to the edge of European airspace to cyber attacks of the kind that we saw in information warfare during the campaign.
David, last question. And we're going to look at this in more detail in the next few days on the show. But a rising issue is the number of conflicts of interest for Donald Trump around the world, from his business interests in Turkey, the Philippines, all kinds of places where the U.S. has intense strategic interests, in addition to whatever, you know, ill-gotten profits Trump might get personally from being president of the United States and the way things would fall to him as a result if he doesn't divest of his businesses. That's probably the smallest reason for him to divest. We have strategic interests in Turkey and the Philippines and elsewhere. What role do you see for these countries in this world, or what option do you see? I guess the best question is, what threats do you see from these business ties?
We've never seen a situation like this because we've never before elected a president who had so many diverse physical assets in countries around the world. So it's a fairly easy thing to put everything in a blind trust. If it's a set of investments, you hand it off to an investment manager. You say, I don't want to hear from you for the next 4 years and try not to lose my fortune, will you? But you don't know how it's invested. Donald Trump has said he's going to try something very different, that he's going to hand the business to his children. Now, he sees his children regularly. The properties have the Trump name on it. People are going to assume, rightly or wrongly, that some business activity that they take in the business realm will give them some advantage, perhaps, in dealing with the U.S. government. We don't know if that will be the case or not. Because Mr. Trump is close with his children, which is a good thing, he's going to see them a lot, and it's sort of hard to figure out how you would guarantee that he's not at all involved in business decisions. So it's pretty complicated, and I thought it was interesting when he was at the lunch with Times reporters and editors on Tuesday, he basically said the president can't have a conflict of interest under existing laws. He didn't sound like he was supremely concerned about it.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, British comedian Josie Long, who's doing a show in Manhattan about Brexit. Brexit comedy. So we'll see how she makes people laugh about the Brexit and how she's relating that, now that her show is in New York, to the election of Donald Trump. Josie Long coming up next.